herzlich willkommen zum Podcast Heilsames Erzählen. Ich bin Iris Maas und bei mir zu Gast ist Laura Sims aus New York. Sie ist seit mehr als 50 Jahren engagierte Geschichtenerzählerin und steht wie keine andere für Healing Storytelling, heilsames Erzählen. Das Interview ist diesmal in Englisch und eine deutsche Transkription gibt's auf meinem Blog.
I'm so happy, dear Laura Sims, that you have agreed to be in this conversation with me today. You are the one for me to turn to when speaking about healing storytelling, because when reading your bio and also your book about the secret territories of storytelling, it becomes so obvious that it's the healing and transformational part of storytelling that is part of your work or the biggest part of your storytelling work. You say that storytelling can be transformational, can transform people or even communities. Perhaps you have some projects that you are doing right now that you have done where we can understand what kind of transformation this is and how this works.
Such a great big question.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the biggest projects that I'm actually doing at present as a result of this sequestering in during the COVID crisis is really having the time, the deep time, to relook again at what actually motivated me to become a storyteller in the very beginning. So I think in terms of what we traditionally think of as healing, there are people who are all over the world doing amazing projects using narrative and healing that are much more active in the therapeutic field than I am. So I'm not a therapist, and I want to honor and give credit to their work. My relationship to storytelling is as a storyteller, and it becomes more and more clear to me as I get older, which is happening all the time, that it is it's not just an entertainment for me or a place to give lessons or a psychological journey. It really is a unique and transformative event because it's working with the living nature of spoken language and the sort of secret architecture of engagement, so that it's working with mind, basically. And in that way, we are, in a sense, restoring something that culturally, for a very long time, we have really devalued, which is a connection to all aspects of our beingness and interdependence with the world and each other. So the very nature of the storytelling itself is, in the moment of performance, a way of almost secretly making those connections happen because of the reciprocal relationship between a listener and a teller. So that's a very general statement, but you know, how did I come to this? And in a way, how I came to it was the very first time I ever accidentally told a story.
And accidentally?
Yes, because I dropped out of graduate school and I took a course at the New School for Social Research, which at the time was a very sort of radical, alternative university. And I went there just because my parents were so appalled that I had dropped out of school. You know, for a Jewish young woman, if I wasn't getting married, I should have a good education. And now I had, dropped out of graduate school actually after 3 days. So this is another story.
Yes.
But But that little spice is also part of the storytelling where you become alert to find out something. And that's where our relationship starts to get juicy. Mm-hmm. But I got into the theater kind of backwards again, because I was standing on a line for a philosophy of art course. And I looked over and there were so many more interesting people on this other line. So I literally decided, oh, you know, I dropped out of graduate school. What the hell, you know? So I got on the other line. Mm-hmm. And it was for a remarkable theater class being run by someone who was at the time in the Open Theater that was attempting to unpack or even evaporate form to find out how theater could become an event that had no fourth wall, no separation. So I was in this class, which led me to be in a Gurdjieff theater, not a Gurdjieff, but a Grotowski mm-hmm. theater company where I was standing on my head, which I was terrified of, and doing all kinds of sound exercise, amazing, 6 days a week. And I had to work late at night as a waitress. And then I got a job, actually, very quickly in a very alternative theater piece. And I couldn't anymore keep my nighttime job. So the director got me a job being a teacher of kids of well-known off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway actors and actresses. And because I can't memorize a thing, I actually didn't know what to do. So I told them fairy tales from my childhood, and we enacted them. This is in my living room twice a week, and we all loved it. And then they made a theater piece, and all their parents came, Central Park. And the parents, of course, loved them, and the sort of strangers, you know, combining derelicts and who knows, passing by, all loved it also. And the parents wanted them to do it a second time. So they said to me, you have to do something in between. You know, do a monologue. Mm-hmm. So I told one of the fairy tales. And what happened in that moment, which has in a way defined my path, you know, like a someone in a fairy tale who does something and then they make the journey for the rest of their lives, was that in this very seemingly structured event that I accidentally came on, something happened between myself and my odd random audience that broke down the fourth wall. And I wanted to know what happened. So I officially dropped out of graduate school. And I thought this would be a small detour, but I'm still on it.
Well, but that's really unusual. Most storytellers that I interviewed claim that they wanted to become a storyteller after witnessing other storytellers. You know, that was an impact. So somehow to experience this special connection with the audience, and that was the starting point. That's really unusual.
Well, I had only seen one other storyteller who had memorized texts from books, who was, mm-hmm. you know, kind of the library style, and she was very lovely. But it didn't interest me. What happened mm-hmm. interested me. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I was very lucky. There weren't that many storytellers to look to. I was at the museum. I got a job at the Museum of Natural History. Telling stories.
Yeah, we know that from movies.
And so I had access to amazing people and their library behind the library. So that really gave me a way to see films of traditional storytellers and ritual events that were shot in the early 1900s. And again, these storytellings were not geared toward let's tell a story that has a moral at the ending, or this is about me and aren't I fantastic. This was something else. I saw Blackfoot woman heal someone who looked lifeless. And when I asked what she was doing, I was told she was incanting a myth into the consciousness. And through the images and the sound of her voice and the constant drum and rattle, her mind was being transformed or opened. I don't know if it's transformed is the word, mm-hmm. but I think it's more that some level of listening was accessed that is inherent in all of us. Mm-hmm. And so that could be that she would heal from the illness, psychological or physical illness, or something in her life would be rebalanced, or she would find the place in which her death or her situation could be felt without utter despair or trauma. So that I'm telling you this, I don't think I knew this in my 20s, but it's what I recognized something, and I constantly wanted to know more about it because I felt that it was not only the content of the word, but something about the sound of the word. And then I began to be very interested in how sound travels between the speaker and the listener, and how the more that people fall under the spell of the ongoing story, the more that there's an immediacy of imaginative response in which the mind expands. So one has associations, and one has the depth of one's emotions can come up without them being edited by trauma or opinion or bias. So it's a kind of very sneaky activity.
Yes, that's true.
Good mischief.
So somehow it's also about your journey is about, let's say, like controlling or willfully using these methods to create this transformational process between listener and speaker?
Well, I hate to use the word control. I understand what you're saying and really appreciate it. But it's more right. that it's a kind of recognition of how there's the story and it has a structure, beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. And usually, because that's how we're trained to think, we look at the story. The story must be the healing. And the story is very powerful. But depending on how the storyteller engages with the audience, that's where the penetrating experience happens, because the storytelling happens on many levels all at one time, in my experience.
I think so too. Yes. No, I did not mean control, but somehow in your first experience, it was happening. And
yeah,
I understood that it's about mastering these qualities.
Yes, I would say that. Then because in every situation and with every story and every situation, if it's one person or it's 9,000 people, mm-hmm. there is a quality of staying sort of awake and alert even while you're in the story. There's a lot of energy, as you know, when you're telling a story. And sometimes suddenly that horse is riding you and whoof, off you go. But how do you learn to, when I was 16, my first boyfriend's brother rode the wild bulls in the rodeo. So I think it's a kind of, I've never been on the back of a bull, but in a way, sometimes I've been on the back of the wildness of my own mind that mm-hmm. is energized by the character, by the witch or the hero, heroine, or whoever it is, or even the place itself. It's just, And how do I both let that be and stay with the story and my audience at the same time? So there is a quality for me of the healing property of a kind of distance.
What do you think is the or are the most important qualities that you needed to develop to become the storyteller you are now?
The storyteller I'm still becoming.
You're still becoming, but on this path.
Well, of course, in general, you want to have a kind of develop an instinct for good stories, for stories that have the potential of really having meaning for your audience. And that doesn't mean that it has to be pointed out meaning, but that somehow the journey of the story is bigger than itself, mm-hmm. and that everyone can be in it. And many, many stories you can, you know, can find that if you're willing to look. So you need a good story, obviously. And I think we all know that. Mm-hmm. But then there's a great Uzbeki Jirau. Jirau is an epic singer. Mm-hmm. And in a book that Ted Levin, who's a wonderful scholar of Kazakh, and Ted in his book recorded a Jirau saying, an epic singer saying, you know, when he and asked, how do you prepare for a performance? He said, first I tune myself, then I tune my instrument. Mm-hmm. So the awareness and presence of the storyteller, which means how are you in your body? How are you? And I don't just mean being mindful, but having some kind of innate awareness of the situation. It's a sort of uncategorizable element, but we recognize it. So that took me to a 37-year practice of Tibetan Buddhist meditation.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I realized that at some point that I knew how to be mindful, but that the awareness was always coming and going. And I wanted to see how I could strengthen that, what would happen in the storytelling. And I was very fortunate for things. You asked another question about the netherworld.
Yeah, because you are like a person that mediates, yeah, between our reality and the netherworld, so to say. Yeah,
so I was once in a private school in New York, and there must have been like 300 second graders, all these. I mean, I couldn't believe that there were so many of them, but they were small, and they completely filled the room. And I told a very long fairy tale. And so two things happened. One, and I've told this story before, at the end, I had a few minutes left. And so I said, well, how was it for you? What did you like to this mass of little people? And a girl right in front of me said, well, I forgot the story already. I said, well, that was fast. What happened? She said, I got married.
Oh, she got married, yeah.
It was so startling. I mean, everybody laughed. The teachers nearly fell over. But I was really thinking about that. I mean, actually, that internal union that the story is moving toward, it actually, she felt it. It happened.
Yes.
So I'm assuming that's her sort of almost symbolic way of saying that that's what happened. We did have an extraordinary time. I don't know if it's because it took place in an airless basement, the collusion of our minds in that situation, and great story. Then I got in the elevator to go up and out. And a teacher was there with a boy who was obviously one of those kids who you have to keep a handle on. And he said, you're the storyteller. And I said, yeah. And he said, Laura Sims, the netherworld needs you.
Oh.
And I, another message. Yeah. And I went out. And it was something last week, actually, that I thought about this again. And I thought, what was he saying? He wasn't saying that he might have been referring to the netherworld in a TV or show or something like that. But in a way, for me, it's that the netherworld is inside each of us. And when we are listening to the story, we're becoming everything, like layer by layer, we're going down into this place.
Yes.
And the images are rising up, and we are becoming everything very, very fluidly. It's not fixed like a film, you could stop it. It's this fluid event, very vivid and ephemeral fluid event. And it does, that place in us that we have been taught is really negative is where all the jewels are kept. you know, like in one story I'm working on now, that actually the wedding happens in the middle of the story. And then you'd think, oh, that's the end of the story. But no, the amazing woman who the hero has sought and found says, well, I have to go off because I rule nine realms and I have to have a council meeting with them now that all this has happened. And here's the keys. And you can go to every room, but don't go to this one room in the basement. And, you know, why did she give him that key is always the question. If really she already knew that everybody had told him not to seek her and he left everything to seek her. Now she's telling him, don't go there. Of course he's going to go there. And he does. And there is a giant chained in the basement. And I thought, well, this is real life. You get married, everything's fine, and then the giant in the basement. So but the story goes on. And then somehow, of course, because he lets fresh air in, the giant breaks out and calls for his horse and so rides around and recaptures the princess, the woman, the prince, our seeming hero, then is like, whoop, out. You know, she is in and he's out, but she gives him instructions. And he cannot overcome the giant himself. He has even further to go. Like the netherworld has not been plummeted here. He goes to a witch who gives him instructions of how to deal with the mother of all demons who is on the top of this inconceivable mountain in another realm, and she's the one who has this old, very funky horse with its back bent and its legs trembly and its ears hanging down and its eyes glazed over. It's actually this horse that has 14 hearts that she has hidden, that he has to risk his life to get that horse so that he can then defeat the horse, who's that horse's brother, by the way, that the giant rides. And it is that horse that who's fed on coal and fire. And the 14-heart horse says, my brother, I could give you fresh clover and raw milk if you would just throw that giant off of you, which then the horse of 7 hearts throws the giant off, and then they leave that world and come to ours. And many other things happen, but it's that commitment to not just heal the symptom or make somebody feel bad, but to create a way that we have the capacity to encounter the root causes of either a psychotic episode or a trauma or even just our ordinary culturally acceptable disconnected neurotic behaviors. To just look at that inside ourselves to gain our strength, the strength of 21 hearts.
Oh, that is beautiful.
Isn't it? It's an amazing story. But also, it's such a hard story to tell because it's so long. You know, an American audience, sometimes people say, oh, if you can tell a story under 7 minutes, people don't have an attention span. Well, I think if you're listening to something just mentally and staving off everything else, you don't have any attention span whatsoever.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you listen from what's called heart-mind rather than mind-heart, then if you listen from that place, you have endless attention. And you keep, it's your story. It's not the story of them. It's your story. And interestingly enough, I think it's dependent on the awareness of the storyteller. And it's taken me so many years, and I so appreciate the length of the journey that it takes. It's been amazing, actually.
I have noticed also when I saw you in Aachen that long time ago, and also in your book, that your stories have a special quality. They are like very epic stories, very long journeys. And one can identify so much with several steps of this journey because it's like a picture of our life, you know, with all these scenes and things happening. And somehow, yeah, I always can recognize things from my own life in this journey. But I never found these stories like written in a book, or perhaps I've not done a good research. Are these stories that you combine from mythology or existing stories and adding things? Is it a combination or invention new? Mm-hmm. Or is it in fact a traditional story that you got from somewhere? Because you told me that the story has a special function. It's very important to have this instinct for a good story. So where do you get them?
You ask such great questions. I hope I can answer. Because they're never black and white answers. Sometimes the story just falls on you. Sometimes it is that I, like a piece of a story will really get me. And the rest of the story, I think, what's going on here? But before I invent anything, and I hope I'm not inventing anything randomly, I really investigate and look at, like, what's really happening inside here? Why does this happen and then that happen? What happens? It's like if you're standing on the shore next to the ocean and the tide has gone out, and then you sort of move the sand, then the water runs in and fills that place. It's like something happens, and because of that, something else can happen. So I try to look at the story like that. But this story of the horse with 14 hearts is actually an epic fairy tale from Romania. And it is not easy to find, although the character that the story is based on, Iliana Cosințeanu, was a character in another Romanian story I told. And I thought, who is she? She's so interesting. And I was told, well, there used to be whole epics about her, but I couldn't find them. And finally, after 25 years, a friend of mine, Zev Feldman, was doing research on Jewish and Roma musicians in the north of Romania. And he stopped on his way back to Bucharest, which is maybe 3-4 hour drive from where he was, at a gas station. In these kind of post-communist countries, the gas station, everything is a little bit like happening all at once there. So he said he went inside while they were repairing the car and putting gas in. And he said on the shelves there was everything from oil and pornographic magazines and, you know, chips. And he found amongst it all a small book of Romanian fairy tales in English. He said, what is this doing here?
What's so going?
He bought it for me.
Oh, great.
Years later, and called me up laughing the next day and said, I bought you a present from Romania. And of course, I'm thinking, oh, he must have bought me like an antique shirt or one of those beautiful paintings. Anyway, he brought this little teeny book to my house, but it was thick. And in it was this incredible story of Iliana Cosințeanu that I had searched for. So I think I have a relationship to the stories. I mean, I'm looking for them, and maybe they're looking for me. And, you know, Native people say that the stories are alive. So I think they come to me when they think I'm ready or I need to hear this story.
Oh, great.
But so that is based on that story. So sometimes I work on a story, and in and out of it, I tell personal narratives. Like I just told you that story about the boy. Because I think that we forget about what happens to our listeners while they're listening. Because they're having their own images. You and I, if we listen to that story, we're seeing something. Who knows what everybody in that audience is relating to? I have no idea. I mean, I could put little things in their head and have tests and so forth, but I could never really know moment by moment what's going on, even though we're sharing this communal experience. We're all going out to play in the same field, but we're having a different experience at the same time. So I began to add these personal stories inside fairy tales and myths, because we tend to think of fairy tales and myths as make-believe and personal experiences as true, where I think they are both mythic and they're both true, depending on us. So I started putting these stories inside and exploring that. Or framing the story, with the experience of where I told the story, that gives you a sense of its life, that it's not just like a museum product. You know, you could buy a little icon or doll or touristy thing somewhere, and it's, oh, that's a nice story. And also then, I really do have to look at when the story was set down and who actually recorded it. I was working in a project with kids on the Lower East Side of New York. That's not far from where I live. Mm-hmm. But it's a kind of very low, it was a low income area now being bought up. But it really has a lot of undocumented immigrants and lots of ethnicities. It's kind of marvelous, used to be dangerous place. And there's an art center that I love. It's small, but it had been a synagogue, one of the earliest synagogues in New York. And when you walk in, there's a kind of very new agey vegetarian cafe. But on the walls, they've kept the old walls from the synagogue where there's marble and Hebrew writing of the names of people. And actually, my grandmother is on that. So I'm in love with this place. So I volunteered for several summers to work with their kids and tell stories because it just amazed me. Because I know my grandmother, who came from Romania when she was 18, was forced into a marriage into an old man who died. And then she was left with one son and she lived on that street, on 6th Street. But anyway, what happened in that place was that the summer project was for the kids to make a map of all the stores and buildings and parks and churches and synagogues and one mosque, actually, all on that street. And then to interview people so that they could see the history. And so they wanted me to tell stories about place. So I thought, well, who lived there before? And it turned out that it was a kind of swamp area near a strawberry field and that the Lenape tribe lived not far. So I began to look up. So, okay, if the Lenape lived there, what story did they tell about the origin of the earth? So they were like, this is a gorgeous story. And there were like 10 versions. And some of the versions were from the Seneca, from the Iroquois, and because of the Six Nations that were all related. And I found one version that I could work with. So I looked at all the other versions for details. There were things that, of course, you know, I felt that I couldn't understand, not being native. I would have to be reborn and initiated and like, turned into another person. But there were various things about this story that were astonishing and that I loved and that I could map and relate to, particularly in this one version. So then I called the Historical Society to find out who the informant was. And I found a detail that just thrilled me and speaks so much to the intelligence and the awareness of these storytellers who were telling their stories to missionaries and, you know, early ethnologists and so forth. And it said that this informant told the story to two different people and told it differently depending on who they were. And that he felt that the knowledge that was in this story, that he could emphasize certain things that was needed by these colonial people who were taking over their world and ignoring the consequences of controlling and manipulating the environment and ignoring the spirit and the actual history. Mm-hmm. And so that just liberated me to be able to tell the story because I felt I was telling a story that was given to my mind and that I could look at the deeper some of the deeper aspects of the story, some I can't. And in a sense, many of these stories are self-secret for the people who tell them because we wouldn't know what they're talking about anyway. At any rate, it was a thrilling to put that together. And I told it over 6 days with these kids so that we would tell a section and then they could rampantly make maps and draw and talk about their lives. So it was the whole thing was extremely thrilling. So that's how sometimes this happens.
How it happens. Wow, that's a marvelous example. I really, really envy you. That's a good project. Was this project taking place before the pandemic? or during?
Yeah. Before, yeah. No, yeah. It was two summers before, because now I'm not, I mean, I had a project this summer with kids online, and I would say it wasn't as in-depth as that one. First of all, I thought the kids were like, they had enough of being online. but, you know, it's just everything, any project, I think, Iris, is a good project to work on. If you start to think about what it is, like, start to think about what's really happening in this story, or what really is somebody asking me for, so that it's not that, you know, sometimes it's very specific, like being hired to go to Haiti and work with health workers who were working in camps with mothers. You know, that's very specific. But what happened, of course, is not always, you know, I can have a project to work on it, and then when I'm in that situation, you realize more about what's really needed than the structure of the project that you've been asked to do. But just somebody just called me now from a museum. It was a wonderful museum in Newark, New Jersey. And so they wanted to do a whole family thing for Christmas, and they decided that their theme would be snow. So they had a whole idea about it. And then, you know, it's like, okay, well, what stories do I know? So I began to really think about it. And then you look up, what is snow? And which people lived in the snow? And suddenly, you know, like one story came up, and then I remember, you know, in my childhood, my brother, who is and was always 7 years older than me, who I'm catching up to now, he used to like to make these kind of snow forts that he could get behind, and then his little sister would come out with their friends and boom, you know, throw snowballs at us. But my mother and I were making a snowman. And then she told me, my mother was first generation from Romania, and she knew a lot of these fairy tales, and she told me this Russian fairy tale of Snegoruchka, of the snow girl, and it was so sad at the end when she wants to become a human being, and she does, but when she's embraced by the young man, she melts.
Oh,
oh, and the snow disappears. I was really upset. So. Yeah. So the next day I wanted to make our snowman into a snow princess. And so we did everything with cloth and my mother's wedding veil and made a snow princess. And my brother did not dare throw any snowballs at us. And the truth is, of course, it melted also. But I had made this wonderful. So then I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to actually tell this story that they could relate to about play, mm-hmm. and my brother and my naughty brother, and then this story, then the context of that story, and then we're going to give them little snowman picture that then they could dress up and make their own snow princess. And the thing is, it doesn't have to melt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it'd be really fun. So I made this out of this snow, and then I remembered another story, a story from Siberia that I loved about a girl who really succeeds. And then just the story of the creation of the world, one of the zillion versions of Inuit story, the creation of the world, where Raven makes the earth out of a snowball. Mm-hmm. So suddenly it just, you know, that's how I can think about it for myself, where I stay interested. So it's not like you don't have the time. It's like, okay, all right, they want me to do something on hair. Hair? Okay, well, so Donna Jacob Sipes in Australia says, hair, you have to tell the story of, what's his name?
Rapunzel. I only know the German name.
Which is what?
Which is Rapunzel.
Oh, no, that's Rapunzel, right. There's Rapunzel. But what is the biblical story of Samson and Delilah?
Ah, yeah.
And so okay. I said, oh, my God, but she captured him. And she said, no, the real story is, you know, 10 years later, they brought him up to humiliate him, but they forgot that hair grows back. So he had all of his strength again. So suddenly hair became so interesting. And in this group of teenagers, they all had such obsessive relationships to their hair, you know, that either they, you know, tied it up in braids really tightly, or they covered it, or they dyed it, or they straightened it. So I had them write stories if their hair could talk. But that's how these things happen. And I think that you ask these questions means that you, somewhere inside of you, this is your love and passion too. You wouldn't ask such great questions.
Oh, I don't know. But it's what interests me. And yesterday I happened to listen to an interview with Barack Obama. He gave it to Markus Lanz, which is a German interviewer who flew over to New York to have this interview. And Obama said, yes, that people basically don't vote on programs, but they vote on basis of stories that best explain and fits to their circumstances. And that it was the task of politicians to change the narrative. And I found that just so fitting to this search that is ongoing for me about this storytelling, healing and transforming with storytelling. So I really feel that perhaps there's also a revival of storytelling somehow, because right now this is the part of our lives, as you mentioned before, that is somehow hidden, or it needs to come up again. Yeah, this magic in the life, or the myth that we want to have to live according to. We want to have a good narrative, a good story to fulfill our lives.
We could have a story that either gives us one single conclusion, or a story that may have many conclusions and open us up. There's a difference. I once went in Poland, in Warsaw, to an exhibit on the origins of fascism and genocide, and it was all about storytelling. You know, this idea of how do you create an outer story that over and over again, so the mind that is already somewhat frail or threatened will believe that story, as opposed to a story that opens up. And I think, you know, you asked what are the qualities that a storyteller needs. And the other thing is, I guess you have to, two things. One, you really have to learn how to listen, and listen beyond your own opinion or what's familiar. And that's very uncomfortable and can be disturbing. So being willing to listen beyond to what's actually being said, as opposed to listening to for what you want to hear or what you think are the pillars of healing. Oh, and then you have to listen to what are the stories. I mean, I think at some point, this is a personal story, but I was walking down the street and a man I was talking to is a very, very brilliant and very public person. And I was saying something and he said, do you know how many times you interrupt and say, oh, but I'm not good enough in some way? And he said, what is this story that you keep retelling yourself? And then I thought, oh, I have to really look at what is this story that I secretly believe in about myself. So as a storyteller, by doing that, then I can hear others. Part of it is the compassion of knowing that this is what we do to obstruct ourselves, and how by not pointing a finger, but in including that in the storytelling in a way about myself, others can find themselves. I was hired once in a school, actually, about four streets away here, the fifth grade, that was having a problem with bullies. There were a lot of, you know, small kids from Asian countries, and there were big kids, you know, who were bullying them and very violently, actually, physically and emotionally. And I didn't know what to do. I'm not, you know, a trained, you know, like school psychologist or this and that. So I thought, well, I know a Cinderella story that has these sisters who are such terrible bullies. And I know this other story from Kurdish Iran, about two brother-in-laws who are really bullies who set out to destroy someone. I just told these two stories. Because, and they were sitting, it was almost like zones, you know, the little kids and the bullies sitting in their own zones. But they were all listening to the same story, all becoming both the cause and the consequence. So when it was over and I asked them, this one big kid said to me, boy, those brothers were like so mean. And I said, well, how were they mean? And he said, well, they did this and they that. And I said, wow. I said, yeah. I said, what do you think happened to the youngest brother? They said, well, they almost killed him. And I just let it be. I didn't say, well, that's what you did. You better be nice. And also then the bully, the little kids listened and they talked about the hero who was love and care more than rage and violence. So it was just an amazing conversation. And then I asked them about their own lives. And one of the bully boys told this story of having to take care of his disabled youngest brother every day. And he was always tired. He hated doing it because he couldn't go out. And it made him so angry. Mm-hmm. And all these kids are listening. And then one of these other kids talked about how his mother during the Chinese Revolution had to leave her home and had one silver bangle bracelet and how she sold it for a bowl of rice for her children. They had never imagined each other's lives. And suddenly, so I never spoke about bullies have to do this, this is how you protect yourself. That wasn't my role, but I created a situation in which they hurt each other. And that's how I learned to do that. And it's more that then afterwards I reflect on what actually took place there. I'm not very good at like setting out these systems for people. So I like to tell the story of it and hope that people can make this their own. But the awareness and the listening and the self-investigation and learning how to look inside the story to see not the beginning, middle, and end, but how everything interrelates so that, you know, and this is a whole process of it. But I love doing that. I mean, it's like a joy.
Yeah, it's really a vocation.
What kind of stories are you telling, Iris?
I'm telling mainly grim stories. Mm-hmm. I started only last year, and this year all my things came to a halt because we had not a strong lockdown, but we were supposed not to go out. And I was especially telling for seniors in senior centers. Mm. So that was obviously not a part to go. And it was a little bit difficult to do online things because they would not have tablets. And
I love that you're telling Grimm's fairy tales to elders because I worked only twice in senior home and, you know, so I thought they would want to hear personal stories and tell personal stories. But actually what they really loved were the fairy tales. They wanted the fairy tales. And I was amazed. Is that your experience?
That's my experience too. I'm with a colleague, with a fellow storyteller called Heidi. And we go there together. So we make a whole program. But we also work with people that have dementia. And for them, they are often restless and they are really not finding peace in themselves. But when we tell the old fairy tales, they can remember from their childhood. And sometimes they even speak with us, you know. There are some formulas in these tales. So they speak them and they really find some rest during the time of our program. So they really, I really like that.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Now, so you know them. That's the place I look for.
That's the place, yes.
Yeah, that's the place. Because listening to a story is, if you listen to it mentally, they're not. They're listening to it like a song. It's like what part of ourselves is opened up in that place of listening is exactly what, bravo, that sounds gorgeous, Iris.
And I was really sad that now I cannot go there. So I volunteered for some hospitals that have that deal with children that have cancer. But so far, I have not been able to make an arrangement.
Yeah.
So let's see. This podcast also is my means of staying in touch. But sometime we will be over COVID, I hope. We will have it behind us or somehow dominated. So
yeah, and hopefully it will do what a good story does. It will open up a deeper, more communal, compassionate way of being in the world because we've been slowed down. And
that's true.
What a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Oh. I have taken so much of your time. It was really a joy, and I need to rehear all that you have said, and probably some meditation practice would be good for me too, I must recognize. So, Laura, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Das war Laura Sims. Infos zu ihrer Arbeit und auch den Link zum Interview in Deutsch findet ihr in den Shownotes oder unter www.irislydiamaas.de. Maas mit M-Doppel-A-Doppel-S. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und eine märchenhafte Zeit.